Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of the New Evangelicals Podcast. Exciting. I think this is episode 23. We are really rolling. And honestly, I have several weeks of podcasts ready to go. And I have some amazing guests that I have coming on soon to record interviews with. And I also have a few that I just did interviews with that I cannot wait for you guys to hear. But before we get there, this is another one of those interviews where I've been sitting on it for a little bit and I'm excited to release it. This is my interview with Professor Jamin Hubner. Now, Jamin is a economic professor at Western Dakota Tech. He's also a Christian. He has a theology degree. He's well-learned. He knows his stuff. And today, he kind of blows the doors off of this idea that I'm sure a lot of you, like me, grew up with, which is to be a Christian is to be a capitalist. And Jamin and I kind of talk about what that means and how capitalism in America is actually more like corporatism and how it's actually destroying the middle class and how that is bad news for any economy. So this was one of those episodes where, for me, kind of being a nerd about this stuff, not that I know much, but just to listen and hear Jamin talk was just so helpful to have some of my like thoughts kind of validated and also some of my thoughts challenged. So I hope you enjoy this episode. That being said, friends, as always, I just want to say the podcast is growing. Our audience is growing. Our YouTube channel is growing. And that's because of you. I really appreciate that. It seriously means so much to me to have people out there sharing these episodes, downloading them, listening to them. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. If this episode really benefits you and you want to share it, we would love that. And of course, if you can give us a review and a rating, that would also be a huge help. It goes so far. Last but not least, as always, if you want to donate, that would be just amazing. It always helps us out. It helps cover our costs, helps compensate for some of my time. I love doing this and I'm grateful for the people who have given. One of the major benefits of people giving is that it allows us to keep things completely paywall free. I believe and not withholding help from anyone for financial incentive. That's just one of my core things I have as a value. And so having people crowdsource and donate helps cover that cost. So thanks so much. All right, friends, enough from me on this episode or intro. Now let's listen to me intro Jamin. Talk to you all later. Jamin, I appreciate you making time, especially last minute. I think we talked yesterday and confirmed this time slot. So thanks for making the time to come on the podcast. It's great to have you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, you know, for our listeners out there, I found you on Twitter. You wrote an article around the time when Russell Moore, his letter was kind of quote unquote leaked, right? And you said, listen, I've actually had a similar experience in a Southern Baptist, you know, academic circle. And I read the whole thing. I'm like, wow, I would love to talk to you more. And then I found out that through this, you know, time that you're also a professor of economies. What's the word? I'm blanking.
Economics
here.
Is the
economics.
Word.
Thank you. I'm like, it's not, you're not a professor of economicists. That's not right. So yeah. And I'm like, oh, that's even better because I have so many questions. So I'm hoping we can kind of bridge a lot of topics here in a short amount of time, but let's just start here. Why don't you kind of give us some of your backstory, you know, with the college that you were a part of and kind of how all that kind of went down?
Yeah. So I grew up here in South Dakota in the, I guess it was a North American Baptist church. kind of a typical evangelical life. Did everything the Awana stuff and the
same
Bible camp and you know, purity culture, young earth creationism, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I wasn't homeschooled like you, but okay. I went to a public school, so I can't. Jessica, she was homeschooled, so she could vouch for that. But
there you go.
And I got into kind of Reformed theology and Calvinism, and that took me to Dort College. Now it's called Dort University, and I studied theology there and went to Reformed Theological Seminary. And I knew from a pretty early age that I wanted to teach in a college environment. So I just, when I learned that, like, I can get paid for lecturing and hanging out with students, and then I get summers off. Sign me up. Sign me up. So I don't care what it takes. So, and sure enough, then I, long story short, started turning my academic interest to other areas. I did my graduate work on gender and women in the church. And it's not something anybody was excited about. It sounded too, you know, whatever, progressive or something.
Right.
So, but I got connected with this new college starting up here in town called John Witherspoon College, and did that for 6 years. And I was, I did administration, I did recruiting, I was department chair and then academic dean, and then taught Christian studies there for that whole period.
Wow.
The institution was kind of moving further right, and it was already very conservative to begin with. And the more books I read, the more experiences I had, I was moving more left. So I left in 2018, not on very good terms. The official reason for my leave, the president said, was because of my publications on gender. I had been criticizing some, you know, Southern Baptist people and their defenses of patriarchy and whatnot. But the unofficial reason was had to do with kind of institutional politics and fundraising, and basically the president lost the campus and wasn't honest with the board about it. And I felt it was my responsibility to be honest about it and do my job.
Yeah.
I couldn't sign the paperwork to legitimize a new campus for the accreditor. So that was also, it's like, well, I was, you know, I was supposed to, as expected that I would. But so that was 2018. And I continue to do, you know, a bunch of different stuff. I'm a curious person. I like to publish and research and teach. And by that time, I was finishing up, or I had finished, I guess, a graduate degree in economics. I'd always been interested in the field. And now I'm even more interested in it now after just digging into different connections between religion and economics, and in particular, Christianity.
Yeah.
On a lot of different levels. Like a lot of our theological language is economic. Redemption, paying off debts, almost all of Christology is economic language.
Wow, yeah, I guess you're right.
So, you know, payment and yeah, I mean, and this has been observed for a while, you know, even models of Christology and different things are deeply embedded in sort of economic situations. And but also just contemporary issues too, like we how do we think about different inequalities and economic problems? And so I got into libertarian circles for a number of years because of, first of all, libertarians seem to understand that the two-party system doesn't work very well. And it's, they're both pretty much owned by the same corporations.
Right.
And
yeah. Right.
Second of all, there's a good nonviolence tradition and an anti-statist tradition within libertarianism. But so I, you know, I founded the Christian Libertarian Review and was the editor of that for 3 years. But then I sort of left that because, of the apologetics of capitalism that was sort of expected. And I've found myself being more critical of economies that were highly neoliberal and capitalist, and just had a lot of kind of cheap high schoolish defenses of states of affairs you just couldn't justify. And there was issues of racism and misogyny too, that's deeply entrenched in anarcho-capitalist and libertarian circles as well. So anyway, I teach part-time with a couple of universities, Western Dakota Tech. I've taught on and off here in town, and then University of the People is a very large online university. I do different research for LCC International University as a research fellow. So yeah, I'm not getting paid a salary like I used to. Instead of like 46,000 a year, I'm getting paid like 6,000 a year.
Yeah.
So yeah. I've had to find, you know, be creative and put my, my skills to work and scraping together an income. I start out with Lyft, and I've done Domino's and all kinds of stuff.
I've done Lyft. Sure. I mean, I live by Philadelphia, so it's a pretty populated area. And, Lyft actually wasn't too bad. It's a lot of wear and tear on the vehicle, but I totally get you got to make things happen to pay bills, right?
Yeah. And it's, you really begin to, when you rub shoulders with those who are not as privileged. I mean, I have family that's supportive. I have a positive net worth. So there's things that a ton of people do not have, and they are sort of trapped in poverty. When you really, you live in that world for a while, that changes your perspective on things too. And you hear the rhetoric of an elite class that's sort of being used to justify economic exploitation. That's the only way you could put it.
Yeah.
So that really, I worked at a call center, and that was like the first time I ever sympathized with anything related to Marxism. Was I just felt like a cog in the machine. I was working for General Electric, and it was just like nobody's treated like people.
Yeah.
And it was just really weird. You know, I grew up on a farm and ranch, and most of my family are self-employed. So there's a tremendous degree of freedom and pride in that. And And so, that was eye-opening, and a number of other jobs too. Just you really begin to see the stratification and the mechanisms that are in place. And the discourse too, that is allowed or not allowed, and it's been quite a journey, and I'm just working on quite a bit of projects on cooperatives and decentralized power and economics and Christianity. So that's kind of where I am now.
So, man, I mean, honestly, I truly feel like we could take the whole hour on any one of those topics, from your transition from Calvinism out of it, which I'm so curious about, to your time at that college. But honestly, like, if you're cool with it, let's hone in on some of this economic stuff, because I've really been internally thinking about things. I am not nearly as educated as you, not even close. So I'm glad to have someone like you who's done a lot of the study to kind of bounce some of these thoughts to kind of get your thoughts on them. And one of them really is, for me at least, you know, the more you brought up a good point of, like, you're working for GE and you felt like a cog in the machine. I grew up in small business. My dad owned his own construction company, right? So I've done that for a lot of years. I worked for Apple for a lot of years in the retail store. I've done Lyft. So I'm also a drummer. I think you're a drummer as well. Yep. So we have a lot of similarities. And, you know, I've realized more and more, I'm like, man, this corporate model is very dehumanizing, and it does make me feel like there is an elitist class that profits off of a working class that, especially now with the cost of inflation, really gets paid an unlivable wage, minimally. You know, I mean, Amazon, the average employee is $29,000 a year. And I'm like, but they're profiting billions a quarter. And I feel like I'm crazy for saying that, because you know the classic attacks. Yep. Oh, that's socialism.
They worked for it. They deserve it. They have the innovation, the brains, you know, it's their property, blah, 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 blah.
Right. And certainly I'm not advocating for someone not being able to be wealthy. I mean, of course, you know, I get that. Jeff Bezos should be allowed to be wealthy. But when you have enough money that you can't spend it in 100 lifetimes, while your people that make you that money are can't pay their bills, isn't that problematic? Am I a Marxist? What's wrong with me?
No, it's yeah. I mean, I used to. There's a lot of different frameworks at which you can approach inequality. You know, inequality is one big topic today.
Yeah.
And there are good reasons for that, because it's worse than it really has ever been. And that's true. Like, if you look at the Roman Empire and the numbers that we do have, and you compare it to the amount of wealth concentration in the United States, the US is way worse. Just in the last 5 years.
Wow.
You know, there was this one stat going around this year, 8 people have more wealth than the bottom 50% in America.
Yeah. I've read like the top 1% has 15 times the wealth of the bottom 50%. I'm not sure how true that, but I read that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it continues to change. You know, like, you know, Amazon's employees were $500,000. Now they have 1.2 million employees, I think. Well, anyway, obviously, you know, you're like, wait, am I a Marxist? Well, I mean, like, who cares? You know, like, so what? This is a label, you know.
Right.
We need to get over our fears of being labeled, you know, like, you know, you watch the Southern Baptist Convention stuff, and it's like, the greatest fear is that someone's liberal or something. It's like
CRT. Yeah,
like that's the worst thing in the world, you know? Right, like to be a mainline Presbyterian, like that's
yeah,
that's,
exactly.
That's Peter Enns's joke. But
I love Peter.
Yeah, it's I don't know. There's a lot to deal with, but in I even read that, you know, the cost of offsetting climate change, presuming all the accuracy of the models and the problems and blah, 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 it would cost about $300 billion to sort of get back on track. And, you know, Bezos is worth, you know, could easily pay for that. Or Amazon is worth more than $1 trillion. And it's like, there's actually the capacity to fix huge problems. And like you said, the problem is it's not happening. And so, I think the big issue is social responsibility. What I learned in neoliberal circles, and I mean, like, I have a lot of experience and I know the rhetoric really well. I went to the free market forum at Hillsdale College for 3 years in a row.
Wow.
And, you know, I got an economics mini grant from Acton Institute. I published for FEE, Foundation for Economic Education. Like, that's the most propagandistic arm of neoliberalism in existence. So,
can you define neoliberalism for us? Because I'm unfamiliar with that term. Is that conservatism?
Sure. What is that? It generally refers to kind of
me. Oh no, am I losing you? I'm losing you. I'm losing him. Is it on my end or is it on his? I don't think it's on my end. Jamin, hey, you there? I see you.
There you are.
Okay. Sorry, that was
start over.
That was strange. Yeah, neoliberalism. What is it?
Slow. There. Now it's back. Now it's back.
Okay. We good?
Okay.
All right. So
take three.
Yeah, take three. So can you define neoliberalism for us?
Yeah. Well, it generally refers to the economic program of laissez-faire free market economics of the Reagan and Thatcher administrations pushed in the 70s and 80s. The terminology neoliberal, so it's classical liberalism. So you have individual liberty, property rights, contract law, combined with neoclassical economics. Okay, now just you're going to have to keep a few words in your head. So you have the classical liberalism. Mm-hmm. Then you have what's called neoclassical economics, which is kind of the orthodox consensus, the textbook or orthodoxy of how economics is taught these days. And it goes back to Samuelson and Marshall and supply and demand and all these different models and kind of an empirical perspective. These two combine, and then with the global economy and things like the World Trade Organization and NAFTA and all these global programs for trade and what that's called outside of economic circles that's kind of critical is neocolonialism. Mm. So colonialism is, you know, the Dutch, the Spanish, the French, the Europeans, the British, they come in and they conquer the world. They commit genocide against indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
They say it's for their own good. We have a divine right to do all this.
Yeah.
The slave trade.
Yeah.
So neocolonialism is like sort of that, but in a modern world, in a 20th, 21st century world, where you have, you mentioned you work for Apple, like they have more or less, you know, labor camps, you know, overseas.
Right.
And in other cases, entire communities have been destroyed by neocolonialism, by companies coming in, taking over, exploiting natural resources, moving on. So neoliberalism is sort of kind of all of that. It's sort of a market libertarianism mentality and globalist mentality that is really entrenched in the way we talk and think about things. And so when we talk about neoliberal capitalism, it's just kind of saying the last quarter century of capitalism in a way.
Okay.
As where industrial capitalism refers to the bigger epoch, the bigger change back in the, you know, post in Great Britain. So
that's helpful. Thank you.
Anyway, I don't think you had some other question or what were we talking about before we,
our internet crapped out. Yeah. I don't know exactly what path we were on. You were talking about how wealth concentration is worse than Rome and just how now, you know, like meaning like how that is, it's problematic here and now. And then you were talking about how in neoliberal circles, these arguments are just not really holding water for you.
Yeah. Well, the idea is that the capital that is generated in today's economy is legitimate wealth creation because it's on the basis of voluntary exchange.
Yes, this is a Ben Shapiro talking point. I hear him a lot.
This is why there's entire chapters in books. I'm looking back at my section of the library, entire books, basically sacralizing property rights and voluntary exchange. Because if that isn't true, then it's coerced labor. Well, as it turns out, as you and I know, it's coerced labor.
Right. I don't want to work this job.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just you don't want to work. It's that you have to if you want to pay your rent, if you want to pay for food.
Yes.
So
exactly.
There's different ways of coercion. And that's the thing, unfortunately, I think libertarians don't address is that you can coerce by the state and armies and police. You can coerce by the market or you can coerce by crony capitalism, which is corporations controlling the state, capturing the state,
yes,
and then using the army, using the police, using the policies, the legislature, Congress, to then pass laws that benefit themselves or force others to work in a certain way. That's why, you know, unionization laws, you know, Amazon spent $10,000 to $12,000 a day for union busters when this union vote was coming up in Alabama, I think, or some southern state, to shut it down, and they were successful. The union didn't form, and it's like, well, we have to see worker strikes and unionization in history. Like, this is a continuation. What it used to be were slave revolts and tax rebellions, right? So this is something Richard Wolff really helped me understand, is that throughout all of economic history, there's always kind of been a class that lives on the labor of others.
Yes.
You know, like a subordinate and superordinate class. So you have the king, you have the subject, you have the state, you have the citizen, and it survives by taxation. You have the feudal lord, and you have the serf. And then you have in capitalism, the employer and the employee.
Right.
So, if that's the case, you know, and this is, I mean, just think about it. There are people, all you have to do is read Friedrich Engels' classic work on the working, the conditions of the working class in England. And Engels is, you know, was a friend of Marx in co-wrote, you know, the Communist Manifesto and whatnot. And he's just looking around describing people's conditions, saying, oh, look at this. This is unprecedented. You have women in their 20s who are pregnant and, you know, also have like two-year-old girls, and they're working 18 hours a day and in the mines, you know, and destroying their bodies and dying at age 35 or 40.
Right.
And there's thousands and hundreds of thousands of people living this way, which no one did before. Like, you know, it's always like, oh, well, if they did this, it must have been better than the alternative. But if you actually look at the story about how capitalism got off the ground, you realize that, well, there was an eviction of the serfs from the manor because sheep were more profitable than people. In terms of labor, because of the wool market, it didn't make sense. So you have the enclosure movement, and you have this mass exodus of people going into the cities, crowding, looking for work, so that they would otherwise die. You know, so to say that you know, it's voluntary labor because you chose to do it. I mean, that just shows like how little experience you have, probably how disconnected you are from people who have been working,
right?
From the working class,
right?
And it is the rhetoric of the capitalist class of employers that control the wealth of the economy. So then, of course, a lot of you are asking, well, wait a minute, you're like questioning the employer-employee relationship entirely. Well, what's the alternative?
Right.
Well, I mean, you can be self-employed. You can do partnerships. You can do contract work. You can do be a part of a cooperative where you're an associate and you own the company. You know, there's a lot of different options here, and they've been going on for centuries. It's just that especially Americans are not, you know, it's like there's sections of Italy that are over 40% owned by employees. And like that entire conception is like foreign to Americans in the mainland. It's like what? Like, how does that even work? Yeah, it's been going for a while, you know. And
well, when you say 40% owned by employees, you mean like the companies owned by employees?
The companies they're almost predominantly cooperative firms, worker co-ops.
Gotcha.
You know, Mondragon in Spain has over 85,000 employees. It's the largest cooperative in the world. It's been in existence for a long time. Sought by and work with Microsoft and other major companies, and it's owned by employees.
Can you explain a cooperative a little more in detail? Because I'm kind of curious, like, what does that mean? That let's say I work for that company, I'm also an owner, so do I control my own hours? Do I control my own salary? How does that flesh out?
Well, the idea is that the workers have control over their own workplace, and that they own the fruits of their labor. The fundamental problem with capitalism is in the employee-employer relationship is that you don't get what you produce.
Right.
You are paid a wage, which is sort of like maintenance. It's sort of like rent.
Mm-hmm.
But then everything else goes to the owner, the profit. So when a cooperative, you have ownership. Say, for example, 100% owned company. So 100% of the company, 100% of the equity is owned by employees, say 10 employees. So everybody owns, you know, 10%. You would then get, because you own 10%, you would get 10% of the profit. Now, so you have the ownership, the equity structure. The second aspect of a true cooperative is also democracy, is that you have power over your workplace, and you have one vote per member. So You want to decide your hours for a week? You want to decide vacation days? You want to decide this or that? The workers just vote on it. It's that simple. Who's going to be the manager? You vote on that. So,
okay.
You know, and there's all kinds of cooperatives, even in the United States, where this whole idea is viewed as anti-American.
Totally.
Socialist, whatever you want to call it, whatever scare word is popular.
Right. right.
You know, Nemasti Solar in Colorado, Home Care Associates in the Bronx, New York is owned by the nurses, by the medical workers. And it's all by, I think, women, caretakers. And yeah, it's like, okay. This is a big alternative, like a great alternative. And for obvious reasons, because it's decentralized power. You don't have one person, one charismatic leader simply trying to extract as much profit from people as they can. And obviously, associates of, I say associates because they're not really employees, of cooperatives are paid better and they have more job satisfaction and they have less. I mean, there's been so many studies in the last 20 years. It's just there's a mountain of evidence showing how much more desirable it is. And even within a broken capitalist economy, cooperatives can compete, if that's what you're all about is competition. So,
well, let me ask.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You this, because you're saying so many things that for me, I'm like, yeah, I've been thinking about this and you're putting it in great words. You know, I've realized long ago that not so much even the small business aspect, you know, but like the corporate aspect, right? Like Apple's a great example. I worked for them for several years. I remember one year I sold over $1 million of product for them in one year personally. And my salary was like $39,000. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I gave them 40 hours a week. You know, my healthcare is adequate. It's not great. I still have a high deductible. I made them, you know, a profit of like $900,000, you know, and I'm like,
yeah.
And they're one of the most profitable companies in US history. They have more cash in the bank than most countries do. They could easily afford a living wage, and they don't. And then people have entire industries defending why capitalism is like the best thing ever.
Right. So what you're to justify that kind of situation, you have to say a number of different things. And it eventually devolves into, different forms of racism too, but different forms of superiority complexes. Is it really possible for someone to work 10,000 times harder than another human being?
Right.
Especially if you're talking about two full-time employees.
Right.
No, it's not.
Right.
I don't even think it's possible to work 10 times harder.
Right.
If two people working, say, 50 hours a week or 60 hours a week.
Right.
No way you can justify on the basis of labor, of just hard work.
Right.
But this happens all the time.
Right.
When this stuff comes up, Elon Musk and you know, his supporters, like, well, he sleeps on the couch and he works 80 hours a week. And there's this whole long list of justifications because, well, you have to, because it doesn't make sense. Now, right. if you abandon that and you realize that's absurd because it is, yeah. Then you have to appeal, you know, to other directions. Like, well, these people are smarter than we are.
Right.
They have abilities and that alone, simply possessing the talents or the skills enough is enough to warrant these massive inequalities, you know, or again, it goes back to property rights. Well, they earned it. They, this, they, that. Well, no, not when it comes to actual labor. So, I mean, again, this, the same, the arguments for slave labor are the same for capitalism. You go down the list, they're all basically the same. And the justifications throughout history have been the same too. Nature has made it this way. This is the best we can do. It's the most productive. It's the most efficient. Everyone benefits. On and on and on and on. They're all the same.
Wow.
And that's
I've
why they
never made that connection. Oh my.
Yeah, well, that's why capitalism is wage labor is called neo-slavery. It's because it isn't quite slavery, but it's like it's sort of the same thing. It's like, well, if you don't like your job, you can leave. You could say the same thing to slaves. If they don't like their job, they can leave. I mean, they might get shot, but just like you might get starved, you know, or you might, you know, get a bad reference that torches you or whatever kind of, you know, there's a lot of crazy things that people in power in the corporate world can do. I mean, look at the Harvey Weinstein thing and all these incredible abuses of power.
Well, and I've been told these arguments to me, like, oh, just find, if you don't like your job, find a better one. I'm like, where? Like, if I knew of a better job that paid more, I would be there already. You know, like, if it was just that simple, like, you just wave a magic wand and boom, you're making like double what you made at your old job, this wouldn't be a conversation. So I agree with you. I found that so far, all the arguments that you're saying that I've heard, I've also have been like, these arguments suck. Like, they're terrible arguments.
Yeah, they don't go very far. You know, they make sense you know, some of these conferences for freshmen in college and these weekend retreats and whatever, you know, where kids are inundated with these type of things. But you don't have to read very much history to understand that capitalism is a product of its time, number one. And it's more than imperfect. And the rhetoric of, often even the rhetoric of freedom, you know, deregulation, et cetera, is really a cover, you know, for exploitation. Now, it's not to say there isn't such thing as oppressive government regimes. And and certainly we've seen in history how oppressive regimes and centralized political power can totally crush economies. I mean, that's obvious too.
Right.
Let me
ask you, because I love this conversation. I want to start steering to two things. Number one, I have a question I want to ask you, because I always hear this response and I want to hear you just respond to it. People have always tell me, well, and this is like a big Ben Shapiro like point. Well, you know, Tim, like, listen, even though, you know, like, yes, maybe you're middle class, you have an iPhone, you have a computer, you have the internet, and no other, you know, the standard of living for everyone has risen over the years. It hasn't gone lower, you know, like, and they quote, most people have, you know, maybe cars or technology or a TV with cable. What do you say to that? Because I hear it, I'm like, yeah, but like, I'm still in debt up to my eyeballs. I still have to work all these hours for a job that I'm not even passionate about. You know, I feel totally enslaved in my circumstance. Like, what is the response to that?
Well, it's not going to be so simple. There's a lot of different responses you can give. First of all, in particular sections of the globe, living standards have risen. There's no doubt about that. Poverty has been eradicated quicker in the last two centuries than at any other period. That's true as well. Something though that Shapiro and others eventually, I mean, they would realize that at some point this argument wouldn't make sense. I mean, again, you could make that argument to slaves. The slave could say, look, I'm doing all this work. I'm not getting paid very much. I don't seem to have many options. You could just save, but look, we built you a new house. You have better machinery than you had. You know, you're getting fed more food, or, you know, whatever. You know, this is justification language. This is the a language of employers or of an elite class that is protecting power. So that's important to point out, because again, this rhetoric has been used before, and it continues to be used in different circumstances, and it just so happens to be used for economic exploitation. So we just should ignore that. usually what Shapiro and others focus on is, you know, the West is the best and capitalism is better than socialism.
Right.
Blah, exactly. blah, blah, blah. It's based on a lot of false premises, you know, as if Stalinism, you know, is like a perfected form of socialism, which it isn't at all. Mm. I mean, even Leninism is very, very different than Stalinism, you know, within the Soviet Union. And most people don't know that. I think the biggest counter argument to sort of the thrust of that is really China. China's not a capitalist country. This is where the language gets really mixed up. People conflate, they continuously conflate capitalism with markets. And they're not the same thing. Markets have existed for thousands of years. Capitalism has only been around for 400, 500, 600 years.
Okay.
Tops. Markets is just exchanging stuff.
Right.
Right. And capitalism is different. You have tradable shares of companies, which has never happened really before on a large scale. Most people in the economy are working for a wage.
Yep.
And the employer-employee relationship.
Yeah.
So you have these basic features, and that kind of is, you know, what constituted. So if you look at China in the last 50 years, it's been the biggest economic explosion in history in terms of pulling people out of poverty. And the middle class is huge, and they consume more than the middle class in America, which is crazy when you think about it, because like, really? Like, we're a pretty consumerist culture.
Yeah,
a lot of people buying a lot of crap, and it's like, wow, you know, and it's it's huge, huge margins. And so, yeah, and a lot of their industry is controlled by the state.
Right.
You know, a lot of it's private too. It's sort of a mix, but it's pretty top down. It's pretty command control. So, yeah, it's, and if it wasn't for that, you know, maybe I could, you know, 50 years ago, I would sort of be inclined to believe that argument, but it doesn't make as much sense anymore. And it really doesn't have hardly anything to do with socialism. If you actually read socialists and look at the history of that tradition, which is very rich and of course predates Marx, which again, most people don't know. They're
Well, and in my mind, they're all one thing. Like, listen, I grew up on a steady diet of talk radio. Okay, like that's just the environment. I did too.
Rush Limbaugh and all
totally
that crap.
Hannity, all those guys. And you know as well as I do, they conflate. You don't Marx, socialism, communism,
all the same.
Big government are like it's just the same thing. So any of those words bring you to the same root: danger. And capitalism, God and country, freedom, free markets, wealth are like positive things in my mind, right? Like that's good. Where do you, let's kind of hone in on like the religion and an economic combination, because I'm sure you know this, but you know, 80% of white evangelicals vote, you know, Republican, conservative, vote for Trump. You know, it's for over, I think over two decades now, that's been really the trend. And a big part of this is that I have seen maybe a very strongly implied connection that capitalism is God's economy, and you know, anything else, socialism, the boogeyman's, you know, that is the devil's economy. And as good Americans, I mean, I had a professor who teaches stuff reach out to me on my account and argue that the Bible supports capitalism by pulling from the Torah and using the markets that we see of exchange as laying down the foundation for capitalism. So this is like clearly ingrained.
I'm sorry to say, Tim, but I don't think you're a good American. So remember, that's the way Sean Hannity opened up every single one of his calls.
Totally.
Are you a great American? Yeah, I'm a great American. You're a great American.
That's right. Megan Ditto's like Rush and great Americans, you know? Yeah.
It's really gross nationalistic patting on the back. Well, anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's forget about that. It's minus.
I didn't mean to trigger you, but you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, I can't even remember the question now. There's so much there. It just blew up in my mind. Oh, the religion.
I got it.
Read Jesus. Yeah. Yeah. Read Jesus. He is not anything remotely close to a capitalist. And by capitalist, meaning someone who is consciously pursuing the profit motive. Someone who is consciously trying to store up wealth for oneself.
Yeah.
You know, maybe in the hopes of giving it away in the future, but for now, take it for yourself. It's yours.
Right.
Et cetera. And is notorious for criticizing wealthy people, regardless of how they got their wealth. Now, people will say, well, you know, back then they got their wealth by unjust means. You know, wealth was accumulated, you know, through course. Again, you know, and what's interesting, I've been reading the Cambridge Companion to the Roman Economy. I am continuously amazed at how indistinguishable the Roman economy is in many ways from our economy today.
Huh.
Like, I can't not call it a capitalist economy. You know, we're not supposed to, because it's sort of, what's the word I'm thinking of? Anachronistic. Mm. But almost everything is there. Division of labor, even wage labor, employees, markets, huge market. There's a whole book called the Roman Market Economy by Peter Thiemann, I think is his name. Only thing it really didn't have was tradable shares, although there is debate about that, I'm realizing. There might have been tradable shares, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So the world, the economic world of that time is very, very similar to us, and the economic inequalities is very, very similar. The class structure, there wasn't much of a middle class, but there was, you know, called the retainers, this group that rubbed up against the elite and sort of functioned as intermediaries. You know, Jesus, nobody really seemed to care as much about how like wealth was accumulated. What they were concerned is what we already talked about, is that people have radical amounts of wealth that they don't need, but others do within their own communities. And that's exactly why you have in the New Testament this continual push to be aware of the needs of your communities and to fulfill them.
Right.
Whether it's in 2 Corinthians or in Acts chapter 4 or wherever, where it's like, oh yeah, like we all want to be okay. It's like the human body. If one part suffers, everybody suffers.
Right. Right.
So a capitalist economy is not based on that.
Right.
It's based on the assumption that subconsciously the invisible hand, not the visible hand or our direct efforts or our direct economic system, will sometime somehow come around to fulfill those needs so that they don't exist anymore.
Right.
Trouble is, how many decades do you wait for that? How many centuries do you wait to see these failures, and the failures continue to grow before you say, actually, this theorem doesn't produce the results? That's the biggest problem with Austrian economics, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, etc. I have a number of sympathies with them regarding central banking and problems and stuff like that.
Sure.
But the biggest problem is it's really anti-empirical. Like, see, I feel a lecture coming on, but I'll try to condense it here. So
go for it.
In the early 20th century, economics and the formulation of neoclassicalism became sort of obsessed with imitating the natural sciences.
Okay.
And they're trying to make economics math and a pure science. And it's still that way today.
Yeah.
Everything's evidence-based. So it swung, you know, Adam Smith and those early economists, they were saturated in ethics and morals and philosophy. That was part of what they did. That's all gone, right? By the time you get to Keynes, it's all about, you know, regression equations and supply and demand models and blah, blah, blah. So they went one direction. So the mainstream kind of went one direction into this hard natural science stuff.
Like sterile, very sterilized version, it sounds like. Just like
And supposedly neutral, ethically neutral, but it isn't at all. But anyway, Austrians swung in the opposite direction really hard, saying that economics is really kind of Platonic philosophy. Hmm. It's like, things are true because, you know, like a triangle has three sides. Right. You know, it just is. You can't really prove that.
Right.
So you can't prove these things. So then when you throw out when you throw out falsifiability from the equation, no pun intended, you run into the problem of dogmatism. It's the same with religion and theology. Eventually, you got to have at least some kind of falsifiability element. Like if Jesus really didn't exist, you know, maybe we shouldn't be Christians. There has to be some right. something there, you know. The problem there then is it's like, well, no matter how much suffering is in the world, no matter how much different capitalist economies fail, no matter how much exploitation there is, that none of that matters because on paper, the theory says that this is as good as it can be.
Right.
So, and that's sort of the danger of different types of economic dogmatisms.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense. I shot that out there.
No. First off, it makes sense. And I know, you know, on my account, I haven't talked personally about like my views on, you know, economics and stuff, but I've been thinking about this stuff. And so when you said that you do this, I'm like, oh yeah, like we have to have this conversation because, man, it's so hard because we're coming up to the hour mark here and I want to respect your time. And it's like, I've struggled, I think for a while of like, okay, my dad, right, grew up in small business, owned his own business his whole life and has gotten, you know, between workman's comp insurance and this tax and that tax. And I live in New Jersey, very high property tax rate, right? My dad, when you combine his experience of that combined with Rush Limbaugh, you have the government's bad and they're ruining everything. And to a degree, I feel that there's some sense of justification there for small businesses because corporations have written laws and tax laws that they can pay almost nothing in taxes and pass that cost on to my dad, who's working to the bone 40 hours, 60 hours, 80 hours a week, right?
Yep.
And still getting taxed in the high bracket and all this stuff. So do you think that, like, I feel like we live in more of like a corporatist society, more than even like a true idea of capitalism, unless I have my terms confused. Because my dad would say, well, capitalism is I can have my own business and be my own man and not be employed by someone, right? But is that kind of the same thing here?
Well, there is no question that the power of transnational corporations today is unprecedented and absolutely it's difficult to overestimate.
I mean, they have GDPs that are larger than countries, like many countries.
Oh yeah, Samsung has its own private army. I mean, and that's wow. You know, sort of the, you know, the goal is anarcho-capitalism. That's the extension of neoliberalism, you know, is to abolish the state, which the state was created to protect private capital. I mean, that's why capitalism and the state have grown together for the last 500 years, more as partners than enemies. But, you know, eventually they start to fight each other and someone's got to win and it's going to be whoever has the most money. So, I don't know. I think people I sympathize with your dad. I've heard those discussions a lot, all these regulations. And definitely the government can make small business difficult. And it shouldn't make it unduly undifficult. The thing, though, is there's so many invisible reasons why we're struggling.
Yeah.
And we just can't quite put our finger on it.
Right.
You know, one of them is inflation in the Cantillon effect.
The what? I'm sorry.
Cantillon.
What's it called?
I always think it has an I in the end, but I don't think it does.
Okay.
The Cantillon effect. Well, it basically just says that, and this is, it's a big deal because everybody uses currency.
Right.
The whole economy operates on money.
Right.
But money is centrally controlled by a single bank called the Federal Reserve.
Right.
And it's undemocratic. We don't have control over it. The government pretends to have control over it. It doesn't.
It's even its own Trump, thing, you know, right? Yeah.
Huh?
It's not even a government entity. It's its own thing.
Right, right. It's essentially private, but Congress elects the people who manage it.
Right.
So it's kind of weird, but the Cantillon effect basically says that the rate of inflation is not the same throughout an economy. So when the value of your dollars goes down over time,
right,
because of money printing and increase of the money supply and other reasons.
Yeah.
But it doesn't do so at the same rate throughout the economy. So like if you drop some ink into one end of a pool,
right?
You see how it's really, let's say it's red. It's like really red and bright. And then it starts to fade as it spreads. It becomes less and less potent.
It's like diluted. It's
diluted. It continues to dilute, but it takes a while. So the purchasing power of dollars is higher as soon as it comes out of the printing press or in the commercial banking sector. So the people who benefit most of it are those in finance.
Right.
And then it trickles down through the economy and down different sectors. Wages is one of the places where it's the very, very last. So it's not just that our currency is being devalued. That's true. But it's that the spread between the devaluation grows.
Right.
So that eventually you have jobs where people can't make a living. So there we are, you know, like that's the big problem. We can't make a living wage, It's like, yeah, it's not just because your employers are greedy. Like that's part of it. But in some cases, some small businesses, they could pay you as much as they could and they still couldn't make it and you couldn't make it.
Right.
And so part of that has to do with central banking. And so that's one issue. The other thing is globalism, is that as a I keep double checking. I think it's 1.2 billion, but I don't know how that can be right. But it must be. We'll say a lot of people, a crap load of people in China are entering the middle class. And they're competing in the global marketplace. Their wages are going up and up and up. Middle class wages, because our economy has been advanced for a while. It's been in the game for a while. It's been globalized for a while. Is just flat. So, I mean, I don't want to create antagonism between Americans and China, especially right now. That seems to be a trend, and that's not a good thing. I'm not a nationalist by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a fact that laborers do sort of compete with each other. Now, if everybody was operating on a cooperative and you didn't have simply capitalist entrepreneurs treating human beings as inputs of labor.
Right.
For outputs, and they made their own decisions about who they would trade with. And it wasn't like this big country that's like bent on building an empire.
Right.
Two countries bent on building an empire, the United States and China. You wouldn't have, I don't think, a lot of this problem anyway. So, but in the current state of affairs, it's you know, my dad went out of business because Walmart was built 35 miles from town. And, for one of his businesses, other businesses are going to go out of business because not Walmart was built 35 miles from town, but other companies were built halfway across the world.
Right.
So,
right.
And people know that. I mean, we sort of all know that and we don't really know what to do. And so we think about protectionistic policies. But that's where we get back to like systemic problems, you know, which they're harder to deal with. And we don't like to talk to them as much because they require such dramatic change, like the abolishment of the Fed, the abolishment
of
employee-employer relationships and other things. So, but that's, I think, one of the reasons. So your dad is right that it is a corporatist economy, but it's definitely capitalist too. And it's hard to really separate them because, you know, capitalism has always been about, you know, profit seeking in a group using other people's labor to get there. Now it is true the corporation is more recent legally. You know, a corporation is an entity that is treated as a single person.
Right.
And because then you have corporations that have more benefits than individuals.
Right.
They had the introduction of the LLC. So the LLC allows one person or your small business to be treated as a corporation. So you have at least the liability benefits,
right?
So that if you get sued, they can't take your house. They just can only take the assets of the corporation,
right?
But that still remains controversial, and in organizational theory and law, about these type of structures that, I don't know.
Well,
inequalities.
Yeah, honestly, we could spend another hour here. Unfortunately, I'm up against a pretty hard timeline on my end. Last question for you, you know, to kind of land the plane. What do we do? like, how do we move forward as Jesus people? How do we move forward as people who are realizing more and more that, like, wow, what I'm growing up in, what I'm living in is like, the game is not stacked in our favor, right? Or even equal. It's really stacked in the favor of the employer getting as much money for the cheapest labor possible, which is something that ironically Marx predicted would happen. And here it is. Mm-hmm. How do we proceed? Do we just deal with it? Can we fight it? What's the next step?
I mean, everybody's in a different situation and people have different options. I think there's a good book about Bob's Red Mill. He gave his company back to his employees through an ESOP, an equity stock ownership plan. That's not quite the same as a cooperative, but it's a retirement plan for his employees, and that's better than most companies. Mm. Why? Well, he's like, I read the Bible, I read stuff about money, and why would I just take all this wealth after building a business and just give it to my family or other people? It's like, this company is the people who built it. It's their company. So I'm going to give equity that really is theirs.
Right.
So if you're a business owner, if you're in a privileged position, you know, that's something to consider and think about, is how can you take your skills and capital and put them into things that are empowering to people. Mm. Mm. And there's a lot of wonderful books on that. And in some of my articles, I wrote one for Faith and Economics called Owning Up to It. I have a lot of good references there. But churches and communities can also, on the ground, just do what Christians do and have done, which is to take care of one another and realize that different people's needs are more demanding than others. You know, and some churches have been doing that. They've been paying off medical bills. You know, medical debt is a huge problem in America.
Yeah.
It's really encouraging to see churches take this seriously. And instead of building something they don't need or buying a plane, let's pay off some people's bills so they can actually not want to commit suicide.
Right.
So there's a really good book actually right here by Jörg Rieger called Unified We Are a Force.
Oh, okay.
That's a really good one too. And how faith and labor can overcome America's inequalities. That's a really good book.
That's good to know.
And he has some good stuff there. So
okay. Well, where can people find you? Where can they read your stuff? Where can they follow you on social media?
I have a website, curiousjamin.com, and I'm on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter. I want to say, unfortunately, but to several of those. But
yeah, I hear you on that. I know.
Honestly, I just want to get my work out there. You know, I joined Facebook when I saw my stats on academia.edu, like from one person share go like this. And it's like, well, I want people to read my work. So
absolutely,
you know, I'm going to share it. And that's what other profs are doing. So,
well, I really appreciate you making time in the middle of the day. I appreciate you sharing all this. I mean, honestly, I would like to have you back to talk about healthcare, because that's a whole different topic we haven't even touched. And, you know, I have questions about that too. So I'm sure we can figure something out. But I really appreciate you coming on and making the time. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim.
Absolutely.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.